Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Roggio. I'm a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of FDD's Lone War Journal. This is Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things in what used to be known as the global war on terror, but we now call the Long War. Today is Friday, so I am joined by my co-host, my friend and colleague at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Benham Ben-Taleblu. Benham focuses on Iranian security and political issues and so much more. He's an expert on the militias and all the things happening with Iran. Benham, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Great to be with you. And not so happy Quds Day.
Yes, exactly. We'll get into that in a little bit, like to hear your opinion on what Quds Day is and what it isn't. Today, also, we're going to have Joe Truesman, our Monday co-host, also my friend and colleague at FDD. He's going to join us as well. He's a senior research analyst at FDD's Lone War Journal. Joe focuses on Palestinian terror groups, Hezbollah, the fighting in the region, militias, etc. Joe, happy to have you on Friday.
Hey, really happy to be here with Bill and Benham. And yeah, happy Quds Day to everybody.
Yeah, right. Uh-oh. I think this might get contentious quickly if we keep praising Quds Day. Well, look, we got a bit to discuss some happenings this week. Israel launched a strike in Damascus that killed an Iranian general, and it's a little bit questionable where the strike took. Did it take place on a diplomatic compound? Should we even care? What are Iran's potential responses to this, and what has Iran said about this at the time? There's a report out there that that on Thursday that Israel's canceling leave for combat units and calling up reservists, blocking GPS signals, supposedly in response to a potential Iranian advance. Then the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, he lauded the Iranian general that was killed. And we'll discuss what his statements were. What does that mean? And should we take him seriously? We'll discuss Al Quds Day. And then finally, has the Biden administration turned on Israel? A lot of news coming out of that quarter from the administration, a lot of pressure being put on the state of Israel. I find this highly ironic. Israel is targeting a terrorist group that attacked it on October 7th, and then Israel is being held up as the bad guy here by the administration. I see zero criticism of Hamas lately from the Biden administration. This is very stunning and very concerning. Anyway, let's get into it. Joe, I'll start with you. So give us the details on the strike that killed the general from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran. He was killed in Damascus. Where did the strike take place? Who was killed? Do we know anything about, obviously it was a senior general, but who else was killed alongside him? What was their import? What was their role in all of this?
All right. So yeah, I'll just keep it super brief. So I believe it was, so obviously earlier this week, I think it was Monday.
Monday.
So this is interesting here. So Israel has been attacking, well, for a while now, for months, actually. Israel has been targeting, let's just say, members of the IRGC, its affiliates, Hezbollah, and others in Syria. And well, so they've been doing this for a while, even before October 7th, of course. There's been a noticeable uptick in strikes against them following October 7th. So nevertheless, just last Monday, Israel targeted these, specifically this Brigadier General Sahedi. But the interesting thing is that where it happened, right? It was right beside the Iranian embassy in the capital, in the Syrian capital of Damascus. So this is a little different than, you know, the usual strikes that we've seen against Iranian figures or Hezbollah figures in Syria. This wasn't some random compound in Damascus countryside. So it was a part, or one can say it was a part of the Iranian embassy. One could say some, you know, Iran says it was a consulate. The Israelis say it was, you know, it was a civilian building used for military purposes. Nevertheless, it was the struck where he was hit was very different from previous strikes. And it wasn't only him. It was six other Iranian advisors, you can call them. And their roles were pretty prominent as far as their seniority in the IRGC. So that's something else that's important. But I think the important thing here is to note, I kind of already mentioned it, is that these guys must have been, these generals, they must have been somebody, at least specifically a high value target, okay? Just because the Israelis would not have risked attacking the embassy, right? Even though they weren't targeting the embassy that was right beside, they wouldn't have risked, you know, destroying or damaging the Iranian embassy if these targets were not high value. They weren't super important. Okay. So these guys were pretty bad. And I'm sure Benham can add a little bit more to this, but nevertheless, Israel says it wasn't a consulate. The Iranians say it was. I guess it really doesn't matter in the end, because Iran's points, like they say, they're going to retaliate. But that's the big thing. It was their seniority, right? And where they were hit. So I think that's this event is what separates from other events that we've seen, other attacks against IRGC personnel.
Benham, do you have more details on Zahedi? And apparently his deputy was also killed in the strike, and the other officers. And should we care that if this strike took place in the Iranian consulate, outside the Iranian consulate? My opinion is the Iranians are sponsoring attacks on Israeli soil every day since the Hamas launched its attack and allies launched their attack on Israel on October 7th. And should the Israelis at this point really give to about where they actually target Iranian generals?
It's an excellent question. And some might say that norms die, or kind of diplomatic principles die, when both sides begin to violate. But there is a cause and effect here in terms of the transgression of those diplomatic norms. Some sources, particularly Arab media sources, have been talking about select, floors or rooms even in that facility belonging to the consulate, and the rest being residential, the rest being something else. That tends to make it a consulate in general. There are lots of places in Washington and around the world that also have divided half consular, half business office space as well. But here's the real proof in the pudding. The Islamic Republic of Iran showed you really how much it cared about these norms less than a year into its existence on November 4th, 1979, with the storming of the U.S. embassy in Tehran. The Islamic Republic continued to do things outside of embassies, to transgress and breach walls of embassies. Remember 2011, the storming of the British embassy, 2016, the attack and the storming of the Saudi embassy, as well as the Saudi consulate. And then ultimately, the Islamic Republic in 2019, if you remember, in Iraq, sponsored by the Iran-backed Shia militias, not just waves of attacks, but attempts by the militias to breach the walls and actually implement on November 4, 1979, implement a hostage crisis in Baghdad. And that was under the direction of Iran's then Quds Force Chief Qasem Soleimani. So there's no reason we should provide them this diplomatic cover, particularly when also further abroad, further afield from home, in continents like Europe, Iran has long used these embassies to ferry weapons, to bring in intelligence operatives, to conduct surveillance, kidnapping, terror attacks. The 1990s, and unfortunately again now, European history is littered with these examples. So I don't think we should be offering, in essence, that the Islamic Republic the option of a human shield. We should take this entire history on one side, and then put the biography of Zahedi, who, like the rest of Iran's major figures in the IRGC, cut his teeth in the Iran-Iraq War, but uniquely led two different branches of the IRGC, very briefly the Air Force, and then for a period of time, the ground forces, and then also served as the Sara La base commander. That's the IRGC base for Greater Tehran. That's a pretty key political military position. And then ultimately his connective tissue with Lebanese Hezbollah and the Assad regime was that he was the Quds Force commander for a little bit under a decade for the Syrian and Lebanese theater. He had a deputy for the Quds Force for the Syrian Lebanese theater that was killed in the same strike, as well as another Quds Force official who was essentially, you could say, a chief of staff for that same theater. So lots of the brain trust, lots of, you could say, the connective tissue, lots of the command and control here for Iran's long arm into the Levant were taken out into this strike. So when you look at Iran's abuse of this diplomatic properties in the past, and you add on top of that the high value of these targets, you could see how what the Israelis did wasn't really a transgressing of a diplomatic norm, but really dealing with the same threats that they've been dealing for quite some time. So I'm in the business of not giving the Islamic Republic this kind of laissez-passe, this kind of option for diplomatic pushback, because that's precisely where they're going. You see Iran's Supreme National Security Council, its foreign ministry now, implementing a diplomatic policy first and foremost to respond. You see Iran's major state patron, Russia, in less than 24 hours, being able to convene a Security Council meeting in relation to this. And in essence, this is really where the regime feels most comfortable, exploiting the tension and the drama and the debate between, one, extraterritorial killing, and two, that this was a diplomatic property, because it knows once it commences those debates in the West, you can set it and forget it, because a whole host of people will say, oh, no, what about our embassies now? Are the Israelis trying to drag America into a war? And that's precisely the kind of hedging that Iran understands exists in our society, in our politics, and is able to push upon, not just with military action, but merely now with words.
Yeah, it's interesting how those in the West forget. And as you laid out, you know, Iran's history of attacking embassies and consulates across the world.
Not to mention, of course, I forget this one because, sorry to butt in, I totally forgot this was a brain fart. The former Iranian ambassador to Iraq, who, as you know, all Long War Journal listeners know, all post-Saddam Iranian ambassadors to Iraq are Quds Force officials. The former one, Hassan Danaifar, gave an interview to Iran's pro-IRGC Tasnim news agency recently, saying some very interesting things, including talking about the need to respond in kind to the Israelis. So again, picking up this "they hit a diplomatic facility" rhetoric by talking about the need to not strike Israel directly, but to go after Israeli diplomatic facilities. And he even gave an option. He even said in Europe. But the reason I'm mentioning this now is, of course, not just Iran's scaling and hostage taking against other embassies and burning and desecrating, but straight up terror attacks using a proxy you all have tracked, which is Hezbollah. Remember 1992, the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires, 1994, the Jewish Cultural Center in Buenos Aires. So it's entirely possible that the regime uses this to beget a debate about how well to respond in the gray zone, not just against Israel, but against soft targets as well. You remember a series of botched terror attacks, I think, in Georgia and Thailand and India. Unfortunately, Hezbollah and the Guard Corps were successful in Bulgaria. So I would keep my eyes on that as well. And that tells you how much they care about diplomatic properties, human life, and culture and cultural centers.
And even a plot in the United States to kill a Saudi ambassador, is that correct?
Yes, at a very overrated Italian restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, but you know, if there is an attack on an Israeli embassy or a Western embassy, people will point the fingers at Israel and failing to ignore Iran's long history of using its embassies as launch points. And look, every country embeds intelligence within their embassies. There's a degree of that. We get it, right? I don't want to be, you know, hypocritical or anything like that. But to the degree that the Israelis use, or I'm sorry, the Iranians do this, is absolutely astonishing. And then when you combine that with their willingness to attack, you know, foreign embassies and consulates and diplomatic missions, you know, you got one side here that's playing a different game, but it's never held up to any type of standards. It's going to be the Israelis that'll be at fault here.
Yeah, you guys tell me if this is the proper phrase. I'm paraphrasing. It's from the sports world, so you have to forgive me. But it's the ref always catches the retaliation, or yes, the ref only sees the retaliation, right? So the movie starts for so many people on Monday with, oh my God, an attack on a diplomatic compound or a diplomatic facility or a consular facility, as if it came out of a vacuum. As if this guy didn't have that, you know, distinguished resume I just read out to you right now. As if Iran's interest in Syria and Lebanon began perhaps that day or a week before. So this is really the, you know, you mastered this phrase, the disconnect the dots, but we lack the ability to link cause and effect here. And we start at the effect, and that's how you get into the world of, you know, the US, at least rhetorically and politically, is, you know, putting distance between itself and its partners, no matter the drama, no matter potentially even the legitimate criticism, but at a dangerous time when the others, the adversaries, the patrons and the proxy networks are bridging the gap, are marginalizing the distance. So this is an own goal, to create political distance as the adversary is narrowing political distance. And this is exactly happening right now. Literally, Hezbollah in the Nasrallah's Quds Day speech is lauding General Zahedi for his role in this resistance, is lauding the Islamic Republic, is saying that Iran is only being subject to so much external pressure because of its stance on Palestine and on resistance and on whatever else. So they're circling the wagons, and all our wagons are going in straight directions.
Yeah. So both my daughters played, still play ice hockey, and they, dare I say, a little bit on the aggressive end. You're absolutely right. The refs always catch the retaliation. They spent quite a bit of time in the box over their long hockey careers. So, yeah, you got that one right, Benham. So what has Iran's response been to this attack officially? And has there, we haven't seen any, at least that we're aware of, any direct targeting. Does Iran play a long game here, or are they quick to act to get revenge? Ben, I'm going to start with you.
I have a view, but I don't want to drone on and on, because I think there's a couple things happening at once. And, you know, we can get caught up in the headlines. You know, number one, and this is, your listeners are sick of me saying this, but Iran is a new missile power. Iran is a new drone power. And because of that, we cannot not rule out an overt attack. Once the capability exists and the intention exists, yes, they can't escalate all the way like the Israelis or the Americans can, but they have this capability. So it's definitely a non-zero chance of an overt kinetic conflict. But what really dampens that is past experience and current methods of warfighting. Past experience in 2022 and 2024, Iran responded against basically a made-up target in Iraq using ballistic missiles, claiming it was a Mossad base in response to perceived Israeli threats or attack. So in this instance, it is possible to see missile action, but against a third-party country, a place that would be a permissive jurisdiction for the Iranians. So they can flex publicly. You can, what's the academic phrase? Face off and save face. You can do it in that way. What I would be very worried about, and there was one unconfirmed report from earlier this week, you guys may know better than I, that there was an attack on a U.S. base in Syria. I hadn't seen it confirmed. This is, I think, a very likely option, that because of the American rush to distance themselves from the Israelis, and distance themselves from the attack, you know, that again cements in the Iranian mentality that they are afraid of escalation, therefore you can get more by escalating. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a reactivation of some, not all, networks in the Iraqi and Syrian theater against positions in northern Iraq and in southeastern Syria, where our forces are located or co-located. And in that way, you can ignite the American debate about the Israelis are the ones who painted a target on our back. And that has a self-fulfilling prophecy for the regime as well. I am worried about that soft targets comments, the threats against Israeli embassies, Jewish cultural centers, not just in the region, but around the world. That is very, very significant. That I think is potentially likely, even medium to long term. The Iranians can wait that one out. I wouldn't be surprised if you have qualitatively different weapon systems, either from Syria or Lebanon, potentially even be fired as well. But in this case, there is a Khamenei speech from a few days ago everyone covered about him saying, I'm going to slap Israel, or Israel is going to get slapped. Which, by the way, this slap phrase is consistently used by Iranian clerics. You know, Khomeini even used to say, I'm going to hit America in the mouth. I'm going to slap them in the face. Like, this rhetoric is longstanding. But I actually went through that whole Khamenei speech about this alleged slap. And there's only a small section about Gaza and Palestine and the resistance and all this stuff. And that's because he still sees the way the war is going, this is my view, as in his interest. As in, no matter the war chronicling and the war stenography and the war journalism and whatever else that comes out in the reports and social media about the Israeli military successes in the Gaza Strip, politically and strategically, Khamenei still thinks he's winning, even though his proxy in Gaza is getting clobbered. And in this sense, if the trend lines are going in his direction, these guys actually understand that sometimes less is more. And maybe 10 years ago, this kind of phrasing would be conspiratorial, but now they're using it themselves. That same former Quds Force ambassador, he used the word strategic patience, sabredah vordi. He said that if we go, you know, go out too big, we could invite escalation, not just from Israel, but from America. And in this sense, this is why the regime seems to be absorbing more than retaliating, or at least retaliating in a certain way. This is just my two cents.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I actually agree with you quite a bit. I think the militias certainly are one avenue. And I do think the Iranians, you know, they play the revenge of the dish, best served cold game quite well. They pick their time and place of choosing. They're not forced to respond. They don't react in the way, you know, in a way that I think they perceive to be rash. They pick their targets carefully and for meaning. Joe, they're an Iraqi militia. Recently, right immediately after the attack, threatened, issued a threat to arm terrorists inside of Jordan. Tell us a little bit about this. I thought this was a, you know, look, we all think, yeah, like you could step up tax with the Houthis and they could do militias in Iraq and Syria. I've agreed with all that. But this one kind of stuck out at me. You and I, we wrote this up for Lone Ranger Journal because we, you know, we felt that was pretty interesting. And given a lot of the political instability within Jordan, how the Jordanian king and queen are really coming out hard against Israel, I thought this was quite interesting. So tell us more about that, this threat.
Right. So just to quickly add, just something that you guys, the previous question, what Betham brought up about, you know, what Iran could do and its responses. I think I just want to add one more thing, because everything you said, I think, is true. But the way I think, too, is that when the Israelis were drawing up a plan to strike against these generals, right? And the way I see it is that they also think about, well, how is Iran going to retaliate, right? What is this worth hitting these generals, right? Is it worth this operation, or what's going to come? And and obviously they went through with it anyway, right? So I think Israel is preparing itself, right, for, you know, the possible reaction or response, right? But I think they feel that Iran's not going to try to start a war here, right? I don't see, it's just, you know, and I just judge by history, right? I think it's unlikely we're going to see Iran, you know, lobbing ballistic missiles at Israel. And interestingly, I want to add too, is that there's a lot of fear, I think, and concern in Israel, right? There's have people telling me from Israel, telling me that, you know, there's people going into the supermarket and taking out money and, you know, rather going to the supermarket buying food and all this because of this retaliation. And I think a lot of that's driven by, of course, the media. But nevertheless, I think Israel's is waiting for the response, but I don't think it's going to be something over the top, all right? Something that's unexpected here. So I just wanted to add that. But back to your question about the Jordan thing. But
can I just ask you guys a question, actually?
Yeah.
You know, maybe I think Bloomberg reported the GPS thing. There's lots of people, even the FDD VP Schanzer tweeted imagery of people driving past either missile components or surface-to-air missile tubes or what could be components for fighter jets on trucks moving towards border areas. You know, individual Israelis taking videos of this as they drive, as well as lots of reports now about, you know, scrambling. And Bill, as you mentioned, the taking off the home leave or the delaying the home leave till later. I've seen the Islamic Republic kind of aggregate these stories as a sign of success. This is their revenge in some way. The freak out, what you were saying, Joe, you know, taking out money, like over shopping, like they're causing this panic. Sometimes states don't need to get to a point B. They can live between the point A and point B because that seems like it's enough. That, I mean, that can be magnified because obviously, and it will be magnified, but in essence, that could be part of their response. Am I overreading this here? Or what do you guys think? Because I actually had a friend in Israel tell me about the GPS thing and how it wasn't working even in parts of Tel Aviv. And it just reminded me of how much I already used to get turned around in like the bars of Nebesedek. Now it'd be like impossible to like Google Maps your way home.
I'll start with that real quick. Look, you know, we have to remember Iran is already at war with Israel, right? Its proxies are launching attacks daily, you know, as I said earlier. So, you know, yes, there are additional things that could be done, but I'm with Joe here and I'm with you as well, Benham. I don't think they need to do something massive, or I don't think they need to go launch ballistic missiles at Israel, but it can be things like Benham describes on the margins, or it could just be ratcheting up more attacks along the border, the northern border. It can be, you know, getting the Houthis more advanced weaponry. I think there's a range of things, or it could be an assassination of an Israeli official, or, you know, blowing up a embassy, or, you know, a consul, or something that I just don't, you know, and I'm with you, Benham. I think, you know, the fact that freak out effect that the Israelis are experiencing right now, that is a victory of sorts for the Iranians. I do think that they're going to want to be able to point to something to say, this is our revenge. But I don't think they need to do that immediately. And I think that what's happening now is quite sufficient for the Iranians to, they're getting their pound of flesh just about every day. I think you had said something too interesting too, Benham, that the Iranians feel that their Khamenei feels that they're winning. And I have to tend to agree with them that the U.S. alliance is fracturing. We'll get into that later. Whether it's superficial and for domestic politics or a real thing, it doesn't matter. It's they're showing cracks in the relationship that didn't, would we couldn't imagine 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And yeah, I'll leave it at that. Joe, what are your thoughts?
You guys got it. It's perfect. I think also, you know, there's like Hassan Nasrallah, right? In his speech, I think he sees what, how the Israelis are reacting, right? So these guys, these proxies, they feed off of that, right? So they'll say, they'll notice, oh, look, the Israelis are all nervous, you know, and concerned and worried, because they, you know, gotta remember, Iran is proxies. They read Israeli newspapers. They pay a close attention to what's happening in Israel. So, in a sense, yeah, this is sort of a victory already. So, and Assad hasn't even been fired yet by Iran, right? So, just the threat in itself could be enough, right? So it's just it's all very interesting. And Bill, I guess I'll just jump to the question you originally had.
Yeah, absolutely. Get into the militia, because this does play into it, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. This is part of the response. I don't think this just happened out of nowhere. You know, the militias are taking cues, as you said, Joe. They're taking the cues from the Iranians. They're taking them from Hezbollah. They're taking cues from each other.
Right, right. And in this instance, a security official, or call him a commander, or one of the leaders of Hezbollah brigades, Abu al-Askari, he published a statement following the strikes in Damascus, saying that they will, Hezbollah brigades has the capacity to equip 12,000 Jordanian fighters, members of the Islamic Resistance in Jordan, which I've never heard about, by the way. Islamic Resistance, I don't know what that is, but nevertheless, he said it.
I mean, and Joe, this could be a possibility of them saying, we're going to create the Islamic Resistance in Jordan, right?
True. That is true. Yeah, it's a good point. But what he's doing here, I think, is that, see, the problem is, just a little bit of context here, Jordan, especially over the last, let's say, week and a half, 2 weeks, there have been, every day there's been protests there near the Israeli embassy. And these protesters are supporting Hamas, they support Gaza, and they're calling for Jordan to end their peace treaty. And of course, they're supporting, you know, figures, key Hamas figures in the war. So this is creating some kind of bit of instability, all right, in Jordan, right? And I think what Abu al-Askari is doing here is that he's just flexing muscle, right? He's taking advantage of what's happening here in Jordan. So he's saying, listen, we can arm these guys, right? We can, something else he mentioned that if they get the green light from Hamas and Islamic Jihad, if Hezbollah brigades gets this green light from these groups, that they can cut off the land border between Jordan and Israel. I don't know how they will do that, but anyway, nevertheless, he said it. So he's making these threats. But again, I think it's just muscle flexing. He's just flexing his muscle, right? I don't think it's actually going to happen. But something interesting I'll add real quick is that overnight, there was a shooting attack against an IDF military vehicle from a person, a suspect that from Jordan. All right. He didn't cross the Israel-Jordan border, but he got close. He took some shots at an Israeli vehicle and went back to Jordan. So I think he's just trying to foment violence here. Askari is fomenting violence here because he sees an opportunity, right? He sees the instability growing in Jordan. So, but it's interesting, nonetheless, because you don't hear a lot about Jordan when it comes to, you know, the Islamic Resistance, or you just don't. I mean, they use their airspace to try to strike Israel, of course, against Jordan's will. Just want to say that. I thought it was very interesting. This happened just a few days ago, the statement that came out.
And I tend to take these threats seriously. I definitely believe it's aspirational, you know, but something that also can't be discounted: what if Lebanese and Iraqi and Syrian fighters start infiltrating into Jordan and become the Islamic Resistance of Jordan, right? You know, but you know, back to the point that Benham was making, you know, sometimes the little things or the unseen things can be just the destabilization. The continued destabilization of Jordan is a victory for the Iranians. The Jordanians, for whatever problems the Israelis have had with them, have been a decent partner for the Israelis to work with over time. And I think we're seeing those relationships deteriorate. It further isolates the Israelis, you know, who have poor relations, you know, or maybe break even relations with its neighbors, with Egypt, with Jordan. Obviously, poor relations to no relations with Lebanon. And those types of things are victories. Any thoughts on that, Benham?
No, other than I agree wholeheartedly. Those are the kind of collective things that make victory. And also these states, as much as they are ideological, they're interested in continuing these conflicts. So it's a series of aggregate moves, a bunch of little things, and these actors, I should say, that get them to this point.
So, Benham, we had briefly discussed Nasrallah's speech. Can you just give us a good summary of that speech? And should we be taking Nasrallah's threats, his statements seriously? Should we take them at face value at this point in time?
Well, it depends what elements of that speech. There's quite a few things in there. We have a friend and colleague who also comes onto the show at FDD at Longboard Journal, David Dawood. Sometimes I used to joke he was the Nasrallah chronicler because he was the first to tweet out like a long tweet thread, basically translating some of these speeches. I was looking at this speech through the English language press and through the Persian language press in Iran, both of them. And you got a couple of themes here. One, of course, is kind of that the axis of resistance is winning, that great victory awaits them. That, I think, is the regular kind of bluster. So is, you know, the resistance in Lebanon is entirely ready. We don't fear war. You know, we actually know that after Khamenei, Nasrallah's speeches also had the same kind of hedging moves, despite them literally commencing their conflict against Israel just a day or so later after October 7. You had Nasrallah lauding the Palestinians, but still physically showing that it was their fight, and this was not going to be, at least in their view, a full Lebanon war. So these guys still talking and acting like they want to have their cake and eat it too, make them look like the drivers of the axis of resistance while having to pay as little as they can for it. The fact that the conflict is still going on, by the way, was also mentioned. You had a lot of name dropping about Bibi, about Gallant, about others. The fact that the conflict is still 6 months and going, and still they haven't been able to get all the captives and hostages and whatever else back, and that allegedly Hamas is still not defeated in Gaza. This stuff is touted as a victory. So you kind of get a little bit of a understanding as to how Hezbollah and the Axis are going to be thinking about attrition warfare, both political attrition and military attrition. And then also just kind of sucking up to the patron was very interesting. The fact that he said Iran was under all this pressure because of its stance on Palestine may be designed to do a little bit of lifting up in the Arab world of the kind of Iranian image and reputation, or at least the image and reputation of the regime, when, you know, people at least living in the jurisdictions that the Axis controls may have actually wanted more, may have wanted a full-out war. So I thought that was actually quite interesting as well. There was also a little bit of bragging, I have to say, someone who looks at Iran policy in its breadth and depth. He talked about it was a good thing that the Islamic Republic spurned talks with America. He literally, I think, used the word reluctant, if I'm not mistaken. So he's saying that the fact that the Iranians didn't negotiate with America, despite this administration repeatedly trying to negotiate with them, is proof of how committed they are to this axis of resistance cause. So a lot of interesting kind of political support to have to justify the position they're in 6 months past October 7.
So today is Quds Day. Is this an official Islamic holiday, or is this a holiday started by the Islamic Republic of Iran? What does it mean, Benham?
Yeah, so it's definitely the latter. You know, Joe has covered this as well. Lots of other people in the pages of LWJ. This is basically a political holiday grafted onto the Islamic calendar. In particular, it was created by the founding father, if you will, of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, designed to galvanize Muslim, but also world public opinion against Israel. He came up with this idea, I believe, during the Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988. And it's held on the last Friday, the last Jummah of Ramadan, the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, the month that there's fasting from sunrise to sunset. And it's designed to kind of create unity between believers and to target that unity politically, religiously, against the Jewish state. So Quds in Arabic is Jerusalem. And it, again, at a time of conflict, these things take on, I mean, already the overtones are anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic, but at a time of conflict, these conflagrations, particularly when they're amplified in Western capitals, somewhat problematically, I have to say, in places that believe very much in free speech, places like London, can actually be dangerous. They can be recruitment tools. They can be, you know, quite this is not the place to say, you know, one is against free speech here, but this is not organic free speech or religious worship. This is an idea seeded by the founder of the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism to try to break into people's religious sensibilities and use and abuse and twist that against the Jewish state. And the fact that these marches and rallies continue to be amplified across the world, sometimes among, you know, Shia communities, sometimes among people who just think that they're doing resistance for the sake of resistance, be it in places like South America, Australia, continental Europe, Canada, is very problematic. And today you have seen and will continue to see not just a whole series of Friday prayer speeches that will tout Quds Day's global reach, but also lots of, you know, pro-regime media and social media amplifying Quds Day as well.
And Joe, has the Quds Day been grafted upon the Palestinian population?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say nearly as much. I'd say in Gaza, for example, now, just this year for, you know, because of the war. But, oh, yeah, it's huge, right? So, and we usually, in past years, what I've seen is a lot of these or members of the Axis of Resistance Axis, whether it's Nasrallah or whoever else, a lot of stuff on social media that they would publish speeches, right? In the last few days, actually, leading up to Quds Day, there was publications by spokespeople, like the spokesperson for Islamic Jihad, Abu Hamza. And nevertheless, yeah, it's huge for the Palestinians, right? And we see this a lot too now, and I mentioned this a lot, but we see it even here in North America. And you see these people just wherever they go and, you know, they protest and you know, lauding Quds Day. And I see some these protests, and I think to myself, do these people actually know what they're doing? And a part of me wants to say, no, they're just, you know, they're like, again, like Benham said, they're just doing it for the sake of, you know, quote, resistance, right? But I don't think they really have a full understanding of what they're doing. At least I hope, right? But nevertheless, very popular among Palestinians, absolutely very popular among those that are pro-Palestinian. So yeah, it's this day, you know, previous years, at least, you know, with Gaza, the Palestinian territories, and Israel, it's been marred by violence, especially in 2018. It was pretty bad in 2018. Nevertheless, it's could say the way I see it, it's just one the biggest day out of the year to hate Israel, to hate Jews, and all manufactured by the regime in Tehran.
Yeah, and it's not surprising to me that this, you know, that Quds Day could be grafted upon a group of people who will carry signs at protests in the West that say things like rape is resistance. So right, when you're willing to go there, you're willing to accept an Iranian, you know, quote unquote holiday. So yeah, no shock there. The final issue, really, we could have led with this one, but we chose to save it for last. There has been the acrimony between the Biden administration and the Israeli government, particularly with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It's been in the open for the last, I guess I'd say, month or two. It really seems to be coming to a head this week, where the Biden administration is insisting that the Israelis not enter Rafah without a plan to provide humanitarian aid and evacuate. And really, they don't want the Israelis to enter Rafah anyway, not in a conventional military sense. They want the Israelis to launch counterterrorism operations. And we've discussed this here on the podcast multiple times. Be a massive mistake. There's still miles upon miles of tunnels. You're dealing with a quasi-military organization, an organization that is organized as a military, and to treat that as a counterterrorism mission, that would be insane. That would be like saying, you know, just after 9/11, the U.S. should not invade Afghanistan, but should have just conducted limited raids while the Taliban was in control of areas, while providing humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. This is basically what the U.S. is asking the Israelis to do. It's absolute madness, and my position is the Israelis should ignore this outright and force the Biden administration's hand on this issue. The longer they delay in a Rafah operation, the longer that this dispute remains public and is out there. But I'm going to ask a question, just a generalized question here, and I'll start with you, Benham. Is this has the Biden administration turned on Netanyahu, and by doing so, the Israeli, the state of Israel, or is this just the Biden administration, you know, being public with its domestic political concerns, or is it a little bit of both?
It's tough to say. You know, there are so many ways to read the tea leaves on Biden and Bibi, you know, going into this conflict, even before one would say that, you know, Biden was different than lots of other Democrats of this generation because of his genuine belief. And of course, if we go in both in Zionism and friendship with the Jewish state, but also you go back a bit, you remember that even during periods of tension between the Obama administration, where Biden was VP, Biden ended up being the mediator. That, you know, could have been because of his closer personal ties, but also Biden kind of had this go along to get along vibe or mentality. That was the same case, of course, when the Obama administration had trouble with Congress. They would have to dispatch Uncle Joe here to kind of mediate and mull over things. And in the immediate post-October 7th space, you had Biden come out quite strongly. There were lots of people in the Jewish community, people from Israel, really proud of how well and how closely he stood with them as the conflict kind of evolved or actually began. And everything that people had predicted about a potential war with Gaza came to fruition. People saw the closeness of the Biden-Bibi relationship and the American military support and the second carrier there and everything else as what people termed a bear hug. I don't necessarily see it that way. People said bear hug because it was designed to kind of stifle any criticism, but also kind of overgive in terms of military and political support such that they wouldn't have to pay costs of having to continue to give as the conflict went down and evolved. But nonetheless, the conflict continued to evolve, and that giving kind of had its own expiration date, such that, you know, there's significant political, demographic, geographic pressure on the Biden administration, not just from the Arab and Muslim and Palestinian community, but among large swaths of the progressive left, who see this conflict in certain ways on TV and in social media and the press and outlets that they choose to read. And it's like living in fundamentally two different worlds. I mean, you know who is and who isn't standing with Israel, not by talking about the Palestinian cause or about a two-state solution, but by people who use the G word, the genocide word. And these are things happening quite literally in Washington today among flanks of the president's previous October 7 supporters. So all of this is a very long-winded way of saying that the administration has tried to keep the military support going while alternating its political strategy. And that has evolved into essentially everything from you know, very publicly standing with Israel to, you know, Blinken's testimony on the Hill to Biden's almost crying speech to fast forward to the drama of the phone call very recently, the quote unquote, not planted, but obviously quite planted leaks about how frustrated Biden is with Bibi and the situation here. And I would simply caution that side. A lot of people are couching their anti-Israel and potentially, I don't like to throw this word around. I don't believe in the mudslinging and the name calling or whatever, but in general, the anti-Israel and even anti-Semitic views as merely being anti-Bibi. And this is quite odd because you actually do have a national unity government right now. And you do have people in Israel of a fundamentally different stripe who, despite them wanting to prioritize the hostage mission over the destruction of Hamas mission, you would still have a fundamentally similar kind of military engagement with Gaza while having to worry about the rise of Hamas's popularity and Iranian potential infiltration on the West Bank in an Arab world that is fundamentally changing like lightning speed all around you. So all of this is to say that Biden doesn't think he can solve this. He thinks he can manage it. I certainly think the crisis is getting the best of him, and their management strategy of creating public distance with your closest partner in the region, I think, is sharply being contrasted by how Iran is managing its partners in the region by bridging that distance. So all in all, understandable to try to kind of pander to a broad tent. But when that broad tent is beginning to use the G word and beginning to live in a fundamentally different reality, I think it's time to call a spade a spade.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, look, you know, there's people out there who joke, you know, Biden has a two-state solution. It's Michigan and Minnesota, right? You know,
because I didn't hear that.
He's pandering to the right, to the Muslim communities and you know, in those two states. And I, you know, the problem is, and as we've seen, right, we've seen, you know, he's having these meetings and with Muslim leaders, and they're walking out. They're saying they're not happy. I don't think he's gonna win that audience. You know, if this is purely a domestic political issue, and if it is, it's highly irresponsible. Because what bothers me about this, and I think Joe, you'll agree with me, the more he gives Hamas and company reason to believe that the administration is turning on Israel, whether that's true or not, the more Hamas is just going to hold out. And you know, the more that Iran and the militias and Hamas and Islam, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the more they believe they could run out the clock. And I think this is fundamentally dangerous. Joe, your parting thoughts on this.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Actually, I think Nasrallah said it a little bit of his speech today. He actually brought that up in a way where he saw the international pressure on Israel, especially from its ally, the United States, and that it's well working in the favor of Hezbollah and Hamas. So yeah, they see this, right? So why would Hamas want to budge on a ceasefire deal when they see Israel's allies and international in the international community just coming down on Israel, right? It doesn't make sense, right? So I think what Biden unfortunately is doing is now he's just mismanaging this, and he's giving Hamas what it needs to survive, right? At the worst time, Biden did great at the beginning, great support, but it just, you know, just went downhill from there. So it's but yeah, I agree with everything what you're saying, Bill, and what Benham said so far. So it's just a crapshoot. It really is. So unfortunately, those are my parting thoughts tonight or right now.
Yeah, and I think there's a, you know, look, I think there's become a dislike from either Biden or within members of his administration with Netanyahu. And I think that's bleeding over as well. And I think it's a mistake, as you said it properly, Benham. This isn't just Netanyahu's government. This is a unity government in a time of war. I think if one of the opposition members that are in that unity government was really against this operation in Rafah and how the Israelis were conducting themselves, they would have and could have left the government if they felt that the Israeli people were behind that. Yeah, this is really, it's really bothersome to watch this play out. But I'm going to tell you, I know, Benham, you had said it, right? A lot of people were, yeah, the Biden administration is going to, you know, the bear hug and the strong supporter. This is where he's going to shine. After watching Afghanistan, I know I always go back to that, but I just sat there and shook my head and said, you people don't know what's coming. And we're watching that develop right now. Now, whether this is, you know, a full break between the Biden administration and the Israeli government, you know, that all remains to be seen. But this relationship has been significantly damaged. Ben, I'm going to let you have any parting thoughts before we wrap it up.
No parting thoughts, no Parthian shots. Just everyone is going to be watching and waiting to see how, if and when the Iranians do respond. I don't want to go back to the whole missile, no missile, drone, no drone, terror, no terror paradigm. But there also was, and LWJ covered it, terror attacks and literally even small-scale insurgency. I think in the dozen plus dead, I think almost under 20 dead in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Baluchistan province from another terror attack by a designated U.S. terrorist organization, Jaish al-Adl. The reason I'm saying this matters now, despite, you know, threats from Iran's quote-unquote West, you know, the Arab world and Israel, but this is in the southeast again near Pakistan, is if we remember in January, Iran was able to conflate the southeast and western threats it faced to publicly signal resolve using missiles in one area to generate resolve in another. So you may see missile action in one direction, and then the media and press in Iran will spin that to say, look how tough we are in general.
Excellent point, Benham. Benham, Joe, thanks for the conversation today. May we all have a happy weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Generation Jihad. Just a reminder, you can listen to us on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe to Generation Jihad and leave us a review, preferably a positive one, but only if we earned it. Thanks again, and we'll see you all again real soon.